Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, June 26th. I'm going to hold off a bit with my comments concerning the global economic outlook for the simple reason next week is quarter end, and I'll examine not just where we are and where we're headed, but also how I'm doing. Sneak preview, I think I'm doing pretty well. And I have to add that I am not covering the financial regulation bill that still needs to be approved by both the House and Senate before it goes for President Obama's signature, for the simple reason that I haven't had an opportunity to look at this key piece of legislation as yet. It would appear for now, though, that banks are prohibited from making risky bets with their own funds, though they can still make limited bets in their own hedge funds and private equity funds, and some banks may have to spin off their proprietary trading desk. Derivatives trading is also limited, though not in the draconian fashion first envisioned. Everyone wants to know what the unintended consequences may be, and these take time to hash out. One thing is for certain, however, and that is that Wall Street will figure out a way to remake itself if need be, and compensation, not what's best for the client, will drive the decision-making. Moving along, as G20 leaders meet in Toronto this weekend, it's the United States versus Europe, with China hoping everyone else forgets it's there. The White House wants stimulative policies and job creation, desperately, before the midterm election, while many in Europe have but one thought on their mind: cut spending and tackle their absurd entitlement system. The White House says we'll worry about deficits later. The EU says if we don't attack deficits now, our credibility is totally shot and no one will buy the bonds we need to continue to keep rolling over at reasonable rates. Just look at what the new Cameron government in Britain is doing. Their austerity plan mandates that government departments slash spending a full 30%. The VAT tax is being increased. Capital gains taxes are going up. Welfare spending is being cut. Public sector pay for the higher levels is frozen for 2 years. But corporate taxes are being reduced, except for this last item, hardly the kinds of moves that stimulate growth. Instead, it is hoped it's short-term pain for long-term gain. Improving confidence in the financial system will eventually overcome job losses. These kinds of measures are being taken all over Europe. But in the U.S., it's enough if Congress can reduce added spending, not actually cut it. The administration is in a box, though. We weren't supposed to see an official unemployment rate over 8%, remember? Today we're at 9.7%, 17% unofficially, with the Labor Department estimating that the long-term unemployed, out of work 6 months or longer, make up a sickening 46% of all jobless workers. This week, the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee offered that the economic recovery is proceeding and that the labor market is improving gradually, but, quote, financial conditions have become less supportive of economic growth on balance, largely reflecting developments abroad. Hardly a ringing endorsement for 3% plus growth well into the future, and sure enough, the final revision of first quarter GDP dropped to 2.7%. Considering the depths of the recession, this recovery has been downright putrid, despite the hundreds of billions spent on supposed stimulus. As to future Fed rate moves, Bernanke and his merry governors, save for Thomas Hoenig, the lone dissenter these days, kept the same language they've been using since March 2009. Due to the labor issue, coupled with low inflation, expectations are, quote, likely to warrant exceptionally low levels of the federal funds rate for an extended period, close quote. Goldman Sachs economist Jan Hatzius, one of the best, doesn't expect a Fed rate hike until 2012 because of the inflation outlook. But if we know it's still all about housing and jobs, if we are to hope to see a robust, sustainable recovery, the news on the former took a decided turn for the worse this week. The May data on existing and new home sales was dreadful. Existing home sales were well below expectations, and new home sales hit an all-time low, just 300,000, smashing a mark that goes back to when such records began to be kept, 1963. New home sales were down 32.7% from April, which marked the expiration of the first-time homebuyer tax credit. Overall, most expect home prices to decline over the course of 2010, even as mortgage rates hit an all-time low of their own, 4.69% on a 30-year fixed. So you might be thinking, well, hey, 4.69% at least means all manner of folk can refinance. and that's proven in the past to be an effective economic stimulus of its own. Ah, but you can't refinance if you're underwater. So here we sit with these low rates, and it's like whoop-de-damn-do. All-star analyst Meredith Whitney added that the primary reason she forecast another leg down in housing is that the banks are getting more aggressive in foreclosing on delinquent borrowers. You're also seeing how the government's loan modification programs have largely been a failure, with a huge percentage of those whose mortgages are modified going right back into foreclosure 3 to 4 months later. So things just don't look good at all. Back to Europe, legendary investor George Soros had the following thoughts in the Financial Times op-ed on Germany and its need to lead. The markets have not been reassured by Germany's leadership or lack thereof thus far because Germany dictated the terms of the rescue package for Greece and made them somewhat punitive. Moreover, investors correctly recognize that cutting deficits at a time of high unemployment will merely increase unemployment, making fiscal consolidation that much harder. Even if the budget targets could be met, it is difficult to see how these countries, Greece, Portugal, Spain, et al., could regain competitiveness and revive growth. In the absence of exchange rate depreciation, the adjustment process will depress wages and prices, raising the specter of deflation. Soros continues, "The policies currently being imposed on the Eurozone directly contradict the lessons learnt from the Great Depression of the 1930s and risk pushing Europe into a period of prolonged stagnation or worse. That in turn would generate discontent and social unrest. In a worst-case scenario, the EU could be paralyzed or destroyed by the rise of xenophobic and nationalist extremism." Just a note on my part, recall this has been a long-term theme of mine. Soros continues, "If that were to happen, Germany would bear a major share of the responsibility. Germany cannot be blamed for wanting a strong currency and a balanced budget, but as the strongest, most creditworthy country, it is unwittingly imposing its deflationary policies on the rest of the Eurozone. The German public is unlikely to recognize the harm German policies are doing to the rest of Europe because, the way the euro works, the deflation will serve to make Germany more competitive on world markets, while pushing the weaker countries further into depression and increasing the burden of their debt. Germans should consider the following thought experiment: withdrawal from the euro. The restored Deutschmark would soar, the euro would plummet. The rest of Europe would become competitive and could grow its way out of its difficulties, but Germany would find out how painful it can be to have an overvalued currency. Its trade balance would turn negative and there would be widespread unemployment. Banks would suffer severe losses on exchange rates and require large injections of public funds. But the government would find it politically more acceptable to rescue German banks than Greece or Spain. And there would be other compensations. German pensioners could retire to Spain and live like kings, helping Spanish real estate to recover." Soros concludes, "Of course, this is purely hypothetical because if Germany were to leave the euro, the political consequences would be unthinkable, but the thought experiment may be useful in preventing the unthinkable from actually happening." PIMCO's Mohammed El Arian in the Financial Times. "This weekend's G20 meeting will likely fuel, not resolve, the heated debate triggered by a combination of exploding debt and deficits in industrial countries and the recognition that many now face a future of muted growth and high unemployment. In one corner stand the Growth Now camp, arguing that expansion is a prerequisite to service their debt sustainably. Without it, tax receipts implode, investment is turned away, and meeting future debt payments is harder. This camp abhors Europe's shift towards austerity, questions Tuesday's tough UK budget, and urges countries like Germany to adopt expansionary policies." Mohammed El Arian continues, Against them stand the Austerity Now camp. They point to worsening sovereign debt ratings, noting especially that, despite Europe's rescue package, Greek and Spanish debt risk is back to worrisome levels. They are concerned a coming sell-off in equity and corporate bond markets will deter new investments and aggravate many countries' debt problems. For this camp, America's request that others postpone fiscal adjustments is irresponsible. Instead, they want budget cuts to lower risk premiums and stave off disruptive debt restructurings. El Arian concludes, "The world is facing deep structural challenges, yet its leaders are stuck in a shorter-term cyclical mindset. Until they break out of it, we will see little more than fruitless discussions national policy flip-flops, and a troubling lack of global policy harmonization. Without action, our future will be disappointing global growth and periodic sovereign debt crises. Let us hope this, if nothing else, is enough to drive the two camps together. And you know how I said that China must hope it is largely ignored? Oh, it will be a main topic of discussion, its currency policy and all, but in surprising the markets by offering more flexibility, China is really just hoping to remove itself from debate in Toronto. Of course, China is going to do what's in its own national interest, first and foremost, and a stronger yuan will boost domestic spending and begin to move their economy away from its heavy reliance on exports to a consumption-driven one. China just wants this to occur at its own pace and at a time of its choosing. But since China's announcement, the currency band has certainly been narrow. It appreciated all of 0.5% this week, and the likes of Senator Charles Schumer will continue to hammer away at the issue. Schumer and his constituents won't care that the last thing China wants is volatility in its currency, which would only hurt exporters and drive away the long-term foreign investment it needs. It also has to concern itself with speculators, given that the government has signaled a one-way trade through its gradual revaluation plan. A few other notes on China. Aside from the floods, there has been continued labor strife, which won't end for the foreseeable future, though as discussed before, rising wages are not an issue. This week, the World Bank weighed in and said that in terms of manufacturers, they'll simply raise productivity. China also began to remove some of its bigger stimulus programs, such as for the steel industry, where new capacity is banned until 2012. Now a word on BP and the Deepwater Horizon disaster. This weekend, all eyes will be on the Yucatan Peninsula to see whether we have a hurricane in the Gulf on our hands by Monday morning that could represent another catastrophe in BP's efforts to capture as much oil as possible before the relief well staunches the flow in August. Any storm of substance in the site could be abandoned for up to 14 days. And of course, the oil currently sitting off the coast could be swept on shore. On the other hand, that which is already on the beaches and in the marshes could be wiped away, which was a past experience in Corpus Christi. A further import this week, however, was a federal judge's decision to block the Obama administration's six-month moratorium on deepwater drilling that is impacting 33 existing projects while not allowing new permits. Experts are advising the president that a continuation of the moratorium could lead to the best rigs and best people going elsewhere, while Judge Feldman, who is hopelessly tainted due to his own heavy personal investments in the oil and gas sector, noted in his opinion that, quote, oil and gas production is quite simply elemental to Gulf communities, adding, some of the plaintiff's contracts have been affected. The court is persuaded that it is only a matter of time before more business and jobs and livelihoods will be lost. The effect on employment, jobs, loss of domestic energy supplies caused by the moratorium as the plaintiffs and other suppliers and the rigs themselves lose business, and the movement of the rigs to other sites around the world will clearly ripple throughout the economy in this region. That was Judge Feldman. Democratic Congressman Ed Markey, though, said the moratorium did not apply to the vast majority of rigs because they are already in production, and that it made no sense to resume deepwater drilling before new safety measures are adopted. One other note on the potential storm, and if not this one, another down the road, oil rose strongly at week's end to near $80, 79. The last thing the fragile global economy needs is an oil price shock. Stocks fell hard this week on fears recovery is petering out, with the Dow Jones down 2.9% to 10,143. The S&P 500 off 3.6% and NASDAQ down 3.7%. All three major averages are back into negative territory for the year. And a note on Afghanistan and the firing of General Stanley McChrystal. President Obama did the right thing following publication of the Rolling Stone article. In fact, in hindsight, most conservative Republicans are in agreement. I was amazed that there was ever any thought otherwise. Conservative Elliot Cohen of Johns Hopkins, author of a terrific book, Supreme Command, Soldiers, Statesmen, and Leadership in Wartime, best summed it up in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. General McChrystal's just-published interview in Rolling Stone magazine is an appalling violation of norms of civilian-military relations. To read it is to wince repeatedly at the mockery of the vice president and the president's special representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan, at the sniping directed toward the U.S. ambassador, at a member of his staff who, when asked whom the general was having dinner with in Paris, said, quote, some French minister is so expletive deleted gay. The quotes from General McChrystal's underlings bespeak a staff so clueless, swaggering, and out of control that a wholesale purge looks to be indicated. Cohen goes on to criticize the president's running of the Afghan war, including the careless announcement at his West Point speech in December that he would begin a withdrawal in July 2011. But Cohen goes on, none of this excuses the substance or the tone of the words spoken by General McChrystal and his staff. The poor judgment shown in political military matters calls into question their broader competence to wage an acutely difficult war. There is, however, a more fundamental issue. Military deference to civilian authority. It is intolerable for officers to publicly criticize or mock senior political figures, including the vice president or the ambassador, who is, after all, the president's personal representative to a foreign government. It is intolerable for them to publicly ridicule allies, and quite apart from his own indiscretions, it is the job of a commanding general to set a tone that makes such behavior unacceptable on the part of his subordinates. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday. For further details, go to StockSandNews.com and click on Week in Review. Have a great one.